Hi. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you, Steve, for the invitation. I'm going to start off by reading a little bit from my last book, The Sky Isn't Blue. And this was like a sort of a collection of lyrical essays. Some of them are sort of like travel essays, and they were written sort of like in a period when I was mourning and also just dealing with a lot of different things. And so I was using Gaston Bachelard's book, The Poetics of Space, as a jumping off point to also go and sort of intimately explore spaces as a way to also sort of explore my own internal spaces. So I'm gonna read just a couple things from here first. And I'm gonna start with a very modified excerpts from some pieces that I wrote while I was at Ocean Beach Pier in San Diego. And these are also partially dedicated to Will Alexander. There it was under the blue sky, the birth and death of Mother. It was Mother's ghost bearing the rain who came to speak of sorrow. When one does not know to abandon her children, she does not know the embrace of death. Haunting isn't for the dead, but for the living. Be prepared for the sea to be your confession. Still, almost fearlessly, she stood there, Mother. When Mother spoke out loud, the first word was blue. Blue was the color of a confession given under the sign of the fish, swimming wildly under golden glints of sunlight, the fish only knew to embrace the sorrow. Sorrow is Mother, is the utterance of an embrace that is the color blue. Can't you feel it with your eyes, the intensity of its sorrow? Only when you encounter death and its embrace can you feel the sun setting behind your eyes. Don't you realize that it's all always leading up to this one moment of death? Here, the caw or beckon of a bird, here, a creature's wound. The wound is the only language that is understood by Mother. Glory is the sun, is the fish's stomach embracing the eyes of death. Or the sorrow is only known when death is a ghost behind your shoulder, that blue embrace. Feel with your eyes, and death might already exist at the bottom of your stomach. I told you already that it would be easy to change, if not for the wound of blue. Embracing the blue death of Mother brings the rain, the night, the feelings. Embracing Mother brings the sorrow, the sky, the wound of confession. I confess that I miss my Mother. Go, little bird, to the blue wound in the sky. Go, taste the death of night and the color of salt, ghostly. Ghosts that flutter like salt in the blue waves that beckon. Ghosts that flutter between the blades of grass and call out Mother in the night. It is night now and I cannot sleep. It is night now and I can sense the nostalgia of rain, but the rain is not here. No, not yet. The rain. Mother, where are you? Here it was, the extracted embrace of a cow's stomach lying out there in the night. Here it was, the salt of sorrow and the blue wound we call home, the home that will soon be obliterated by the color of feeling, the ghost of blue. The home that will be covered over with your confession, a dying fish out in the sun, neglected, haunted, the cow is the fish set out to dry. The cow is the stomach that churns during the sky's clear and resonant confession. The heat is what you feel when you wake up in the morning, the heat of a million dying fish. It is night. It is blue. Where is Mother now? Bring the light, says the dying fish. It is already here, says the dead cow. You are ghosts already, sings the sky, blue and salty and hidden under your wound. The ghost is what you feel when you wake up in the morning. So it's interesting for me to be back here, actually, in San Francisco. I was born here, but I haven't lived here for quite a while. And my mother passed away about 6 years ago, and her ashes are scattered in the bay. So whenever I come back, I always feel like I'm coming back to visit my mother. So I'm going to read one other essay from this book, and it's the last essay called The Dogs. And mostly I'm reading this because today, Brenda and I went on an adventure where we climbed up this hill and there were lots of dogs everywhere. And so I feel like they were asking me to read this particular essay tonight. And we also saw a coyote, who's also a dog. The dogs bark from inside the home. The home, inhabited equally by air and bodies, creaks and moans under the weight of the wind. The dogs lift their heads at a sudden noise. A hand turns a doorknob and the dogs bark. Who is entering their home? The air owns the home more than the dogs do, but the air is silent, complacent. The gestures of dogs are translated into empathizable ones, but when they cry, and when they sleep, they sleep. The dog barks because he is scared. The dog barks because he doesn't like you. The dog barks because he is alarmed. The dog barks because he is sending a warning. The dog barks because he wants to be heard. The dogs do what they're told, or so it seems, but at the risk of distorting sincerity into honesty, we breathe. The dogs breathe better when their master is home, the breaths using the air built up in the space over the course of prolonged time. The dogs have been at home for an unspecified but prolonged amount of time. The master knows how to keep time, but for the dogs, time has simply passed. When the master breathes, the dogs can follow, and breathing becomes knowable again. The bodies become knowable to the other bodies. When the dogs breathe loudly and calmly, the master breathes a sigh of relief because their relief is her relief, and in this home, the breathing bodies huddle close together for warmth, the gray sky yet looming outside the window. The master wonders if and when it will rain. The dogs know that it will undoubtedly rain at some time in the future. The master wonders what the dogs are watching for outside the window at night. The dogs are just watching the outside of the window at night. In every story, there is a home and a dog barking. This story starts with a dog barking inside a home, and then the reader asks, why is the dog barking? The dog is barking because he is scared. The dog is barking because he doesn't like you. The dog is barking because he is alarmed. The dog is barking because he is sending a warning. The dog is barking because he wants to be heard. In every dog, there is a strong and urgent desire to love and to be loved. The incapacity of humans to be their primal and sincere selves is the incapacity to inhabit the dog the way the air occupies the home. We only know to coddle the dog and to love the dog as a dog, or in some cases as a child, but a dog is more than just a dog, and we are mere humans. When an airplane flies overhead, to the dogs a noise, to us an airplane that has just taken off. Contours of a personal narrative include time, character, space, but also hair, fur, noses, sand, points of transition into others. The dogness of dogs as having hardly anything to do with dogs. Consider the quiet of the morning and then the sound of two dogs breathing. Consider the darkness of night and then the light of the moon only minimally obscured by the moving clouds. A dog's head on your leg is all the love you need, all the love in the entire world. One dog places his paw on his master's leg because he knows this is the thing to do. The master wonders how the dog knows what she needs right now, another warm body that affirms her existence, placates her need for something. The other dog walks over and yawns, then curls up next to her other leg. The master wonders whether the dog is cold or sleepy or lonely. The dogs wait for the master before going to bed because in this house the bodies sleep together and it is nighttime when it is observed as such by the master. The master persists because she has the dogs and their love is heavy and beautiful and she knows to persist for them. The dogs persist because they know to persist because that is all they know. The dogs are sleeping because they are tired. The dogs are sleeping because their master is sleeping. The dogs are sleeping because it is night. The dogs are sleeping because it is time to sleep. The dogs are dogs and they sleep because they sleep and they breathe because they breathe. For her own part, the master tries her best to not make any more mistakes. Okay. So I'm going to read some brand new work, actually. So I just finished a novel manuscript called Imagine a Death. And I'll say a few different things about it. It sort of takes place in a sort of disintegrating world, not so different from ours. And there's fires that are consuming everything. And when I started the novel, it was a lot less real than it is now, but cities are shrinking or being swallowed up. But at the same time, people are also doing what they would normally be doing and just trying to get through. And it circles around three different characters. There's a writer and a photographer and an old man who is just constantly archiving things and moving furniture around his house. And they're all dealing with different traumas that they've inherited in different ways. So one of the things that I'm exploring is how the narratives of trauma can be told in different ways, and sort of what the kinds of narratives that get told are also leaving out. So I'm going to read a few different pieces, but the first thing that I'll read is actually just the opening sentence. Some of the sentences in here are very long. But just to give you an idea, I'll read you just this first sentence. They're not all this long. There are normal sized sentences, but not this one. And this is from the point of view of the writer. Imagine a death which really occurs. That is, not the death which devastates inside a dream as you sleep, the kind of dream from which you wake up sweating, the gray sheets dampened in the room suddenly filled with the cold sweat of someone who has been asleep for an intolerable amount of time, alone in the dark. The kind of dream in which you wake up and want to call your brother to see if he is still breathing. Are you alive, you want to ask, knowing that the answer is yes, and knowing he is home in his bed, dreaming his own dream of wanting to occupy another body that is not his own, dreaming of his mother, of when she was alive, and you recall the particular dreams you have of a mother that are different than his dreams of the same woman. And when you are awake, you imagine all the cold and hard touches of a love buried, then excavated violently from the foul-smelling earth, the grappling, bloodied body of your dream, the imagined death of a loved one that is so common on these sleepless nights when it is easier to dream of death rather than life. And when the imagined deaths of movies are so easy to digest as the scene of a decapitation of a lovely maiden, the close-up of her neck, the careful removal of her necklace, this fictitious and choreographed scene which is designed to induce tears and empathy. And without fail, you are bawling and imagining the suffering of a girl who is only 16 and of those who have dared to love her, and you can't feel the warmth leaving her body, but you can imagine the anticipation of the quick death that awaits her. The slight itch on her nose that can't help but become an afterthought in the moment before a death when she does not want to spend the last few seconds of life scratching her nose. Her hands bound behind her, her lips pursed and waiting, the graceful trail of blood that leads away from the scene. No, not a death like that, but a death which really occurs outside the window at night. The sitting tensely in the dark, listening to the irregular noises of animals that signal pain and fright and injury. The screeching of a cat out there in the bushes, quick scurries in the dark and frantic confusion. And she might try to stir herself out of bed and put on pants before slipping outside barefoot in an attempt to track the source of the cursed creature, in an attempt to do something to at least witness the event, whatever the event might be, though the now too long silence seems to indicate quite clearly the circumstances of the event itself. And she already knows how this ends, how it always ends. And if she has heard the scream, it has occurred already. And if there is now silence, it has occurred already. And if she is starting to feel that tightening in her chest, it has occurred already. And if she doesn't close her eyes now, it has occurred already. And right now, she can't handle that kind of heartbreak, not when she has been trying to fall asleep for hours, and though she can blame the sleeplessness on the noises outside, and though she has managed to doze off for a few moments at a time, she has only dreamed of death, which perhaps is still more of a relief than to dream of sitting at home in front of a fire that warms and gives the false picture of an elusive peace. And the ghastly kind of contentment that terrifies husbands into running away from their wives, that asks children to forgive the repeated abuses of their parents, that convinces fish that the confines of their tanks are the borders of their world and the edges of their universe. And while she lies awake, she finds herself constantly swatting away the moths that circle and build like a gradually growing swarm, building up on the walls and windows and lamps of her room, and she finds them drawn to her face, illuminated by the moonlight coming in through the window, the brown moss clinging to her cheek when she is sleeping, and she thinks, there has been enough death for one night. She has already had to smoosh 17 moths with a tissue and flush them down the toilet, so there is no chance of them coming back as ghosts to enact their revenge and haunt her for her offenses against their species, but also to hide any evidence of the fact that she has had to kill so many moths in recent nights. And though she believes that she has no moral objection to killing the flying creatures that disturb her immensely, she is afraid of the potential consequences of killing these symbolic winged things, and also of sleeping under a full moon when the sky is so full of ash and her heart is so full of provisional drowning, for she will, after all, be judged only for her actions in the end and not the tangential tinges of guilt or shame that accompany any of them, her fingers squeezing each other and her eyes wet and open in the pitiable darkness. So that's the first sentence of the novel. And I will read, so the novel also has, it mostly circles between these three human characters, and it sort of circles around their vantage points, but there are also many non-human vantage points that become increasingly important and start to take over the work. And so there's sections from the point of Tree of Moss and pea plants. The old man has a garden, and so some of the plants have sections. The writer has a pet dog, and the dog has sections. So plants and animals also are characters because they're all also part of this sphere of influence. And so I will read one short section that is about the tree. A gnarled red tree that sits, and the night refuses to rain. But in the morning it rains, and some of the others confuse the passage of years with the bursts of stars. But when a man is hung, his body hanging from the branch of the thick trunked tree, it is not only the little boy that screams and is hushed quickly and told to be a man. And at the bone there are cracklings that become seams that split and unravel, and in these tension areas new seeds might be planted, and the keep-out sign might be uprooted by the tree's massive roots that keep growing below the surface. And bye-bye mother, a girl screams in her sleep, but winds sweep over the imaginations of the dirt. And even the bones become dust, and even the dust becomes soil, and even the tree becomes a piece of paper disintegrated. And when the body is thrown into the ocean, it wrinkles from the salt, and the softness that once was compassion or sadness becomes the light. And when the light meets the water, we name that history, we name that secretion, we name that land. And when the moon reaches its fullness, the light is so very bright, and we are standing, as if hypnotized, in the endearing shadow of history. And though the ocean is very far away, the sky is right above us. And what is more elusive than infinity, what is more elusive than the very dimension you think you live in, the woes of repetition, or the wounded haunt the space you lie in? And when you realize the smallness of your own impenetrable past, there will be no reckoning, only silence. Okay, now I'll read a section on the whales. I don't know if anyone watches the old Star Trek. If anyone's seen A Voyage Home, where the whales save the world. Do you guys know this? The whales save the world. In the future, all of the whales are extinct. And so they have to travel, Captain Kirk and Spock, they have to travel back in time to find whales in order to communicate with the aliens so the Earth isn't destroyed. Anyways, the whales. What is the pattern of predictable sounds that, in its steadfast refusal to cooperate with its interpreters, shakes you at your chest, wraps its oral tendrils around your waist, and asks what you see in your future? She was seized by the fullness of survival. And as the last boat sped past, she gritted her teeth and shouldered her body next to her mother's. Seams of space closed off by flesh, and as the water began to clear, she was able to see again. She scooted up to look into her mother's eyes, and the eyes let her know they had seen everything they needed to see, or there had been nothing to see at all. They had, in the past days, seen many of their friends disappear or leave, any insistence on coalition heard silence. and there were less and less tiny things to swallow up, less and less places to hide large bodies from those that lurked in the shadows above the shadows, so that swimming to the surface to watch the dust dancing in the sun was no longer a relished pastime. Her mother had tried to remain connected with the others, but they were afraid that her visions had been a bad omen, that there were so few of them now because of what she had seen, and that they would fend for themselves better far away from her connection with the kingdom of the dead. She had now known that before her there had been another, who had died before even seeing the sky, and that her mother had carried that other upon her back for several days, the others urging her to let go. But how does one let go of everything? How does one simply allow for such finality when it is a piece of you that must be discarded and dropped into the sea? "I won't pass this on to you, I promise," her mother would whisper every evening. Especially on full moons, she would watch her mother's eyes cloud over, tongue tucked back and voiceless, but water running along the contour of her massive body. And her mother would hum as the moonlight rode over her skin, and when her eyes cleared like the water and when she spoke again, it was always the same. She didn't want to confess to her mother that she had started to feel the shudders too, that sometimes during the rainstorms she could feel a tiny voice like a grain of rice trying to reach her lips, her resistance making the voice more insistent. And though she wasn't afraid, she didn't want to worry her mother. Her mother knew enough deaths, had enough ghosts following her, hated knowing the fate and endangerment of their kind, but without the others could do nothing about it except to sing. That eerie melody that carried through the water and over the surface, through air currents and upwards into the atmosphere, the kind of melody that human composers strove for years to construct, but here it poured out of her, more than just a song, but a lament, an intimate tether to all other forms of life. A resonance that even the pigeons with their blank stares roosting on telephone wires would feel, but perhaps not be able to parse. But this wasn't a sound to be parsed out or interpreted. It was meant to be heard and received and felt and transposed into tears or waves or touch, the openness of a broken heart. Another day ended, and the light bounced off of the trembling surface, two whales bobbing under the starlight. "I like the night up here," she said. "We can see the stars." "They are not our stars," her mother responded. Both knew more than they let on to the other, and when the blue of the night finally ran out, they awoke to another boat passing overhead. She didn't know why, but this time, instead of swimming deeper and hiding, she had a feeling penetrate and a voice that ebbed inside her like the tide, and so, in a flurry, she turned to her mother and only whispered, "Don't worry," as she swam upwards to meet the dangling hand slowly slicing the water. The hand connected to a little girl was gentle. The little whale jumped up, and the girl beamed in excitement, though the girl wasn't alone. There were two men with her, each with various recording devices and other equipment, and they spoke words to each other, and the girl responded, and as more lights turned on, the girl leaned into the water, put her hand on the whale again, and said simply, "Don't worry." The whale bobbed there for a moment longer, the girl's hand still resting gently on its head. And when the girl finally removed her hand, the little whale ducked its head underneath the water and returned to find her mother. That night, the girl and the men could hear the whales singing. "They are singing to save the world, the entire world," she would say. And the men, with their fragile devices and advanced machines, would record the music and nod in agreement but say nothing. Just nodding from time to time as the songs would create spikes of different heights on their screens, all of the lamentations of two grieving souls seeking intimacy articulated in the rise and fall of jagged black lines. And somewhere out there the whales would swim and sing because they were alone, but with each other a reminder that loss and exile are linked. And the sound was a way to stay connected with the movement of their bodies through the water, and the air, and the sky, and the tremblings of the earth, and the breaths of all the living beings. And that night, there were more lights in the sky, even more stars being born, and an unanswerable tether to time. And I think I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm.